This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. If you're a parent or an educator, these statistics may sound scary. 15% of all school absences are directly related to fears of being bullied. 20% of students report having been victims of physical bullying. 6 out of 10 teens report witnessing bullying at least once a day. And 60% of middle school students say they've been bullied, while only 16% of staff believe that students are bullied. Those statistics come from Just Say Yes, a national organization devoted to helping teens avoid risky behaviors. Bullying has been in the spotlight for years now, but the numbers of reported incidents in Vermont are staying pretty stable. About 600 to 700 incidents are reported by schools around the state every year. But that's likely the tip of the iceberg when it comes to kids being aggressive, mean-spirited, or worse to one another. Today on the program, we're going to look at bullying and harassment and talk about steps parents and kids and educators can take to prevent the behavior. Bernice Garnett is chair of the Agency of Education's Harassment, Hazing, and Bullying Advisory Council and a professor of education at UVM. Professor Garnett, it's nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Mike Dryblad is a member of the agency's council as well and the president of Stand Up to Bullying, an organization that conducts workshops and presentations on all types of bullying prevention for students, teachers, and parents. Mike, it's a pleasure to have you with us as well today.
Thank you, Jane. Good to be here.
Bernice, could you start just by telling us the difference between bullying and harassment? I mean, they're similar behaviors, but there is actually a legal difference.
That's a great question. So bullying is typically defined as behaviors that are repeated. So a one-time incident does not fall under the category. That are intentional. So intent to harm has to be a part of that category, as well as a power imbalance. And what I mean by power imbalance is that the students who are engaging in bullying behavior are generally of a higher power than the students receiving them. And so those three-part definition is similar to harassment, how it can play out. But harassment is very specific in that the behavior has to be motivated by an identity that's either perceived or claimed by the individual that falls under some of the federally protected categories. And Vermont actually has several more categories that we protect in this state in addition to the 5 federal categories.
So, for example, if a victim is perceived as gay, that aggressive behavior, the bullying behavior, is classed as harassment because it is against somebody's identity in that way.
Exactly. And that process is complicated, as you can imagine. But at the core, that's the difference in the definition.
Mike Dryblad, there's actually an age range where bullying and harassment peak in among students, and that's 4th to 8th grade. Why are those years really the higher years for bullying?
That's a great question. It seems that during that time, students are going through profound changes in their life, including trying on new personality characteristics, experimenting where they are in the group, what their place is, and they will try on these new personalities. What we as adults in these students' lives need to do is let them know that you need to take that jacket off. You need not to wear that bullying jacket. It doesn't look good on you. They're trying out new personalities. We as adults need to come along and say, that's not a great personality for you. Let's try another.
Well, what happens, though, after 8th grade? I mean, it seems like high school is such a tense time for teenagers and there's so much going on. So why doesn't that just continue to rise?
Well, that's an interesting question. It seems that students are coming into their own to a certain extent. They've now discovered their place in the group. They found their personality that's working for them. But we also see that bullying in high school tends to morph. It's no longer guys pushing guys into lockers or somebody telling their boyfriend or girlfriend what clothes they could wear or who they could hang out with is what we start to see. It begins to become those early signs of dating relationship violence, relationship abuse.
We're talking about bullying today, and I want to invite listeners, I want to invite you into this conversation because I know educators, parents, there are so many questions that people have and concerns and some experiences that can help illuminate some parts of this conversation. So if you'd like to share yours, your questions, or your experiences, you can post them on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. or call 1-800-639-2211. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. Professor Garnett, going back to the ages, though, of when bullying peaks, why not before fourth grade? I mean, you and I both have young kids, and even my three-year-old can come home and say, so-and-so put snow down my jacket, and then I did it to him, you know, which certainly in fourth grade would be bullying behavior.
Right, right. And I think we just use the term bullying generally in the fourth through eighth grade range, but we can talk about bullying behavior, generally mean behavior, starting much earlier. And if you look at the core of why young people and adults, for that matter, are engaging in these behaviors, if you look at the outcomes they serve, it's really to gain social status. We know from the research that students who engage in bullying behaviors actually gain social status. It's to establish group boundaries. I'm part of this group, you're not. Or potentially protect a romantic partner, right? And so if we think about those outcomes and we reframe the conversation about bullying to be less about the students who are engaging in bullying are bad kids, but how do we get them to have those outcomes, right? Feel powerful, feel like a leader without it being antisocial, right? How do we teach them pro-social leadership skills? Because bullying behaviors are actually quite natural in terms of our animal kingdom hierarchy, right? They've been around forever. They just have intensified, particularly with the internet and social media, and also become much more pervasive. And I know probably at some point in the show we'll talk about, you know, social influences and all of that. But bullying behaviors at the core serve very specific outcomes that are natural for humans to want to strive for.
Okay, so let's dive right into it, and we can circle back around all of these various different ideas and sort of swirl through the conversation today. But Mike, I'll come back to you on this as well. But Professor Garnett, how do you try to infuse those kinds of powerful feelings in students, but redirect them into more positive behaviors?
That's a great question, particularly for me as a parent. But, you know, something called social-emotional learning skills are becoming much more common to be really explicit teaching too. And unfortunately, the U.S. education system and different local municipalities, we do a great job from the K to 3. And then, you know, testing and academic subjects take precedence. And we no longer teach about emotional skills and speak to that nature. But unfortunately, that is actually a disservice, because without students being regulated, feeling safe and engaged and protected, they're not going to be able to engage in their academic subjects. So an emotion revolution is happening slowly, where folks are recognizing that emotions matter. And actually, Lady Gaga is championing this. She's partnered up with the Yale Center for Emotional Intelligence to really validate that we need to be thinking about emotional intelligence and empathy. Empathy is one of the things we know from research protects young people from engaging in bullying behaviors. So if we can stop, you know, focusing on just don't bully and reframe the conversation about giving kids a toolbox of things they can use to feel like a leader and powerful, that I think that would change things dramatically.
So Mike Dryblatt, what's in that toolbox for you? I mean, you speak to parents and kids and educators about how to deal with these kinds of situations. What are some of those tools?
In terms of students that are bullying, the professor is correct. It serves a purpose. It meets a goal. We need to give our students other tools to be able to meet their goals. That social-emotional learning that she was talking about is so important. Being in situations where you can actually be powerful, feel your power without hurting someone else, seeing adults in your life who are actually practicing social-emotional learning, being kind to others. Students tend to be, they follow what we do, and we can tell them to be kind, but if we ourselves are being backstabbing or using language that we're not supposed to, they will follow that lesson. It's so important for adults to make sure that we're modeling correct behavior. Also, if we put students in positions where they can feel powerful without feeling aggressive, be aware of their good social status in a group. That's why karate, gymnastics, church group, 4-H, having lots of different activities for students is so important, so they can feel powerful without having to feel aggressive.
You know, I thought we might get into this later, but Mike, you just brought it up, this idea of adults modeling the behavior that we want to see. How can we possibly expect young people who are learning how to be adults, learning how to navigate this world, to be kind to one another when there is so much incivility out there, and when adults who are interacting, especially online, especially with new technology, are really being cruel to each other, using language that we would not want our kids to use, and are acting in a way that is designed to sort of show power or to diminish the voice of another person? How can we expect our kids not to be doing that as well?
So role modeling becomes so important.
You know, the good news is that most students are not bullies. Most students are not the targets of bullies. Most students are bystanders. And teaching students bystander behavior, so if we hear somebody being rude, how do we go over and say, hey, that's not okay? Or if we see somebody being aggressive, how do we stop that without being aggressive ourselves? We have to role model the behaviors we want to see in students. Most educators are doing a great job of this. Most parents are doing a great job of this at home. Does the outer world sometimes impact on our students, and do they see and hear things that they shouldn't? Absolutely. That's where we have to come in and be another voice and offer a different opinion.
But Professor Garnett, if we as parents are doing a good job, but the world at large is not, surely it's one and the same. I mean, surely some parents who are telling their kids don't be a bully are then being a bully online. I mean, I think we're often not exactly two-faced. Well, maybe two-faced.
Right. Because, you know, it's hard to admit the fact that you might be engaging in bullying behaviors, right? But if you think back to your own childhood, even myself, I probably was engaging in bullying behaviors at some point in my life to establish those things I was talking about, right? What the key difference now is, I think, in this current social landscape is that young people are recognizing that there are different identities that are socially sanctioned to target. And what I mean by that is that young people see from the media, see from the current or past presidential campaigns, from their school that it's okay to target, whether it be queer youth, youth of color, youth with a different ability or different weight status. And that's what's most concerning, is that it's no longer bullying behaviors. We're moving into, these are actually specific types of forms of harassment. And that elevates the conversation and galvanizes movement where it doesn't just rest on young people, because the bullying conversation really, to my mind, rests on young people changing it. And if we move into harassment, then it's a community, a collective conversation, because it's no longer just about kids being mean kids. It's about kids are sponges of society, you know, and that they're soaking up the fact that there are social structures and hierarchy that are present, that are deep, that run a long history of pain in this country, and that they're all coming to fruition right now.
And do you have statistics that show that it's heading more in that direction here in Vermont?
Not necessarily in Vermont. And unfortunately, researchers writ large are a little bit slow in the way that we publish research and whatnot. But there are citizen researchers out there and great national advocacy groups that have published really tremendous reports since the election. The Southern Poverty Law Center put out a report called The 10 Days After President Trump Was Elected, and gathered 867 hate-related crimes that were reported either on their website or different media accounts. And what's most concerning is that a third of these crimes were in the K-12 setting and perpetrated by young people. You know, you probably saw on the media a whole lunchroom chanting build a wall to Hispanic students, right? And then individual students saying, I won't wear this anymore, or I won't speak Spanish out in public because I'm afraid that I'm going to get deported. And that educators are uncomfortable, don't know how to address this in their classrooms, right? And then most recently, the Human Rights Campaign put out a report surveying over 50,000 students, and students are connecting the language from the campaign, the election, to what they're seeing in school. They're actually making a causal attribution, saying we're actually seeing young people mock that same language. We're actually seeing much more heightened targeting towards Muslim students, towards queer students. And so that, to me, is really clear in showing this connection between our young people and society. It's no longer that society's out there. It's right in our homes, whether or not we are great parents or not.
I will say we're also hearing anecdotal evidence of students who have conservative views saying that they feel unsafe to express those views too. So it's not just some of the categories that you mentioned, but often whatever your political beliefs or the political beliefs of your family that you may be parroting, depending on what age you are, that is an unsafe space in schools at this point, you know, all the way around. We're talking about bullying. We're going to get to some of your questions and emails in just a moment. If you would like to share yours, our number is 1-800-639-2211. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your questions and comments on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Peter from Moortown is a high school librarian and says, one of our best tools to counteract the urge to bully in schools is a focus on reading to build empathy. Recent research studies at Stanford University and Emory University show that stories positively affect the way the brain learns and processes information. In short, if someone is told a piece of information, a small section of the brain activates to process that input. In contrast, when information is acquired through story, the brain's empathy centers light up, almost mimicking the brain activity of someone who'd actually experienced the same described event or emotion. To learn about ourselves and others, we need empathy, and there are a few better ways to acquire it than through the power of story. And again, on this idea of empathy, Ted in Shelburne says, Roots of Empathy is an evidence-based classroom program which has proven effective in reducing levels of aggression among school children while raising social-emotional competence. Founded in 1996, the program aims to foster the development of empathy among students from kindergarten to grade 8 in Canada. The program is delivered in English and French and reaches rural, urban, and remote communities, including Aboriginal communities. Roots of Empathy is also delivered in New Zealand, the Isle of Man, and the United States. Again, more of your questions, your experiences coming right up as we look at bullying and harassment today on the program. You can call 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking about how to prevent bullying and harassment and looking at ways to deal with the behavior, whether you are or your kid is a victim, a participant, or a bystander. We're talking with two members of the Agency of Education's Harassment, Hazing, and Bullying Advisory Council. Bernice Garnett is a professor of education at UVM and chair of the council, and Mike Dryblatt is president of Stand Up to Bullying, an organization that conducts workshops and presentations on all types of bullying prevention, and he's also a member of that organization. If you have a question, you can call 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Jen wrote in to say, my son has been bullied for years from the same student. We had always trusted that the school would take care of it. However, the only thing we ever heard from the school was that they had talked with the other student. This year, we finally requested a formal investigation. We also heard that other parents requested an investigation into the same student's behavior. We received a letter stating the investigation was concluded and they talked to the other student. In other words, nothing will happen. We're frustrated by the local school system, who not only protects the harasser, but also puts the responsibility of keeping it together and not responding to the harassment on my son. Mike Dryblatt, how do you respond to Jen?
Well, first of all, I'm so sorry to hear that this has been going on for so long. The good news is, in Vermont, we do have model policies and procedures that are put out from the Agency of Education that schools are supposed to adopt, school districts are supposed to adopt, and this parent may want to go and find out what the policy, what the procedure is in her school, in her school district, and hold the school accountable to following that procedure and making sure they are enforcing their policies. School law, school policy carries the weight of school law in Vermont. And so that's considered a law. If it's in policy, they have to follow their policies. And if they have procedures in place, monitoring that they are following through on their procedures becomes critical. Parents and schools need to work together as a team. We can't simply trust the other teammates to do the right thing. We have to be there with them.
We got a question from Melissa who says, as the mom of an almost 9-year-old girl, this has been challenging. I question when to talk to the moms, the other moms, or when to let the girls hash it out themselves. It's not really bullying, but just mean girl type of situations. Professor Garnett, what would you suggest to Melissa?
I think that's a great question. You know, you don't want to be too overly, in front of your daughters and censor behavior that's actually developmentally appropriate to try to wrestle through. So some of that might be painful, but those are really important life skills to try to wrestle through. But I think setting some ground rules and talking through with your own daughter and potentially engaging the parents about the ways in which we would want to conduct ourselves. And when a conflict arises, because conflicts are natural, right? How do you deal with conflicts? And that's why I think new models such as restorative justice and restorative practices that are being implemented in school can be translated right down to the home, where when a harm is done, let's think about repairing a relationship as opposed to focusing on that harm and thinking about blame or consequences. Because if the consequences aren't meaningful, that behavior is just going to repeat, which is why suspensions aren't really an effective form of dealing with bullying and harassment behaviors. We have to reach out to the young people who are engaging these behaviors, try to figure out why, because they're most likely in pain to some degree themselves. themselves, and then think about restoring that relationship at the individual level and then at the school level. So I think restoring relationships should be key in any harm situation.
What does that actually look like? I mean, I won't ask you to role play with me, but I mean, what does that look like in a school?
That's a great question. So a lot of schools are utilizing restorative practices in the forms of talking circles. And talking circles are actually a great way to deal with lots of different behaviors, but mostly to prevent bullying and harassment because it teaches empathy. And talking circles ground you all in a specific prompt or situation where you get to hear other folks' experiences, right, as a preventative model. Or if there's a harm being done, peers are actually being juries in school where they get to hear from their other peers what this conflict was and then what are appropriate reparations for that. And that the young people engaging in that harm can actually have a voice in, this is what I would like to do to try to restore this. So there's accountability on that young person as opposed to the school administrator coming in, dropping down the consequence, and then there's no voice for the young person.
Mike, we got a question from Janice in Starksboro who says, national statistics show that students with disabilities and students of color are bullied and harassed at much higher rates. What statistics can you share about Vermont, and what advice do you give to parents of students with disabilities or parents of students of color?
Well, there certainly is truth to the fact that those of us who are different in some way tend to get bullied or harassed more. Too fat, too skinny, too tall, too short, different ethnicity than the general population, we tend to get bullied or harassed more. Teaching students how to have a response to send out that message, I am a force to be reckoned with. If you mess with me, I am going to have a response. It's so important. In Vermont, where we have a smaller ethnic population, that can be a real problem. We wouldn't call that bullying. We would probably look at that as more of harassment. Harassment is a bigger deal on the continuum. While bullying, of course, is upsetting, harassment involves state, federal, local policies and laws. And so we do have probably a higher level of response when it comes to harassment. That comes so important to being on the team, where parents, students, and staff are all working together to stop this behavior. Having students involved in middle and high school is such an important factor. The restorative practices that were mentioned before are so important for students to reclaiming justice in their school. If you shut down our classroom, if you stop us from learning, you've affected us, and you need to know how you've affected us and see if you can make up to the rest of us. That's that empathy training, which is so important. Many students, they will say or do something not because they always believe it, but because they've gotten a reaction from the crowd or they've been reinforced in some way. Giving them a replacement behavior so that they can have status in the crowd without hurting somebody else, so important.
What's a replacement behavior? Give me a specific idea of one.
So again, if I'm making fun of somebody and I'm getting the crowd to laugh at me or getting status in the group, is there a way to get status in a different way? Such as through athletics or debate or theater or dance or some other way that I can find a group that will accept me, like me, give me status, but I don't have to hurt somebody else to get that status.
You know, you mentioned that it's important for a young person who is being harassed or bullying to have a response. And, you know, there's that sort of old school parental response that if you get bullied, you should just punch that kid in the jaw. And I don't think that's what you're saying. But there's also the fear of, you know, if you stand up to bullying activity, there's a fear that you may incur either greater violence or more bullying, that it may backfire as a tactic for, you know, how to make sure that bullying stops. So what do you mean, not just the bystanders, because I get that whole group response that if the group is saying this is unacceptable, then, you know, it's not going to have the response that the bully wants. But if you're an individual who's being bullied, how do you stand up to it in the absence of bystanders supporting you?
This is Mike responding to that. When I work with students, we talk about having a variety of responses. Depending on the circumstance, you can respond in a different way depending on the circumstances. Some parents do teach their child just go and punch them in the nose. If I knew how to punch somebody in the nose, chances are I wouldn't be bullied. And by the way, we've talked before, bullying is about that abuse of the difference in power. If there's five of them and one of me, punching somebody in the nose isn't going to work so well. We also sometimes hear parents say, ignore or just walk away. Not great advice, but not the best advice either. It seems the new research says that you need to assertively tell the person to stop. There needs to be a response, and then walk away. Or you can warn that if they don't stop it, I'm going to go to an adult. For certain students, warning that you're going to go to an adult feels like a babyish sort of behavior. So if that doesn't feel comfortable, just go to that adult who you can trust and who you feel safe with and tell them what steps you've done to try and stop the behavior. In an emergency situation, any adult will do, but I usually recommend going to an adult who you can trust, who you feel might actually be helpful.
So whether or not you say to the bully, I'm going to go talk to an adult, you should still do it, but you don't. You can gauge the situation for whether or not that feels like an appropriate response to say to the bully.
Exactly. In middle school or in high school, even warning that you're going to go to an adult somehow feels like, ooh, baby's going to go to the adult. So if that doesn't feel good from a status point of view, simply get out of the situation, immediately go to that adult who you can trust.
Let's go to Louise calling in from Southern Vermont. Hi, Louise. Go right ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. What are you thinking? What do you want to say?
So what I wanted to share was that I'm a mother of a middle school child who experienced bullying that ultimately led to a premeditated assault, my child being poisoned. It turned our family's life completely upside down and took us down a path no family should have to go. During that difficult time, I had the opportunity to speak with another mother who happens to be a councilwoman in Pennsylvania. She shared with me that her daughter had been bullied relentlessly to the point of becoming suicidal after she had ultimately been pushed out into oncoming traffic. This mother felt like the school failed in getting a handle of what was happening to her child, and so she lobbied in her hometown to change school policy to hold parents accountable for repeat offenders by fining them after a period of time in which it was presented to the parents that their child was reported of having been bullied in person or online in repeated cases. And I have since read about this policy being implemented in other states also, and I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Louise, I'm very sorry to hear about your experience. That's awful. Professor Garnett, what do you think?
Yeah, first, again, I'm terribly sorry to hear your experiences, but unfortunately, I'm not at all terribly surprised that you felt not validated and heard and that the right things were done by the school. So, you know, this is a tough situation for everyone to deal with when it's chronic, intense, and very severe types of bullying. So Vermont policy actually has a stipulation for an outside independent investigation if the behaviors were deemed as harassment. And that's where the Human Rights Commission in Vermont would come into play, where you could reach out to them if you felt that the investigation led by the school, that the school wasn't being held accountable. You could go to an outside party, but that part of the policy is only true for harassment, not necessarily for bullying behaviors. You know, it's interesting that this, the woman that you talked to in Pennsylvania, parents are part of that policy. I find it hard to how they would implement that in a way that was visible and transparent, because parents are generally very hard to reach out to from a school-based perspective. So if we then diffuse the accountability farther beyond to a parent community, I worry that then the school's even more trapped and their hands are even more tied on how to deal with it, where now I have to engage in a parent that might just shut down. So that's one concern that I have on that. But it's an interesting idea. But most importantly, it's everyone's problem, which really should be the framework. It's not just the principal's problem or my problem. It really has to be everyone's problem, because even vicarious experiences of bullying behaviors are detrimental to young people. So that's not a great answer to your question, but I don't think it has to fall on one person's shoulder, because that's never going to move the conversation or the behaviors.
We got a note from Mimi who says, I've done a good bit of research on bullying, not just on what constitutes bullying, but on how bullying experts measure and define it. What I find is that a majority of researchers and others involved with this issue have a compartmentalized, fragmented, and generally biased understanding of bullying. The result is that the majority of bullying goes unnoticed and uncounted. One problem is that our society normalizes bullying behaviors that are associated with natural gender traits. For example, sexual harassment dismissed as boys being boys, while other bullying behaviors are inevitable outcomes of a society that's based on hierarchies and dominance paradigms. I think all of us need to start understanding bullying in a much broader, holistic context. It is an ever-changing range of behaviors on the continuum of aggression that arises from a society that teaches aggression, division, hierarchies, and dominant submission models. And Grant says, I'm an organizational psychologist who's worked with several schools to reduce the incidence of bullying and harassment. Unfortunately, most administrators only count reported incidents as evidence of the incidence of bullying and harassment in their schools. The number of reported incidents, however, bears no relationship to the actual incidence of bullying and harassment. Schools with good reporting procedures that support victims can have a high proportion of incidents reported. At the same time, schools with poor reporting procedures that don't support victims coming forward will have only a small proportion of incidents actually reported. The most important single step schools must take is to conduct periodic climate surveys that ask students and teachers about bullying and harassing behavior they observe and experience in the school and in the community. Professor Garnett, do you think that's true, that bullying is way underreported?
Yes. It's clear both of those listeners did a ton of research for their responses, because the adult definition of bullying that I gave at the beginning of the show, right, has to be repeated, intentional, and a power imbalance. That's not the way that young people understand or experience bullying. So our best measures, where we prompt a young person, have you experienced bullying in the past 30 days or any of these behaviors, are generally going to be underreported because they might not identify with that term or not identify with that definition, right? So that first comment about we need to be thinking about bullying much broader is a great idea, because I feel like bullying in schools is overdone. People are over the term. It's been used for every situation. And in order to galvanize more energy around this topic, because schools are burnt out from the bullying conversation, even though there's tons more work to be done, I think we need to be focusing on the behaviors in the broad spectrum. But as Mike pointed out, there are very specific policies and laws that are connected to the term bullying, which is why it's hard to deviate from not using it, because that's where the laws and legal ramifications are in place.
Let's go to Kate calling in from West Lebanon, New Hampshire. Hi, Kate. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I actually run an after-school program in the area, and have been noticing, obviously, before the election and after, certain children voicing their opinions because of parental views, and other children kind of jumping on that. And I just have a question on how to address it to the parents without seeming like I'm trying to step on their views. In a sense.
Yeah, Kate, I hear you. Let me put it to Mike. How can Kate bring up that sort of political bullying without engaging in a political debate?
Great question. We have to make sure that we're respectful to the parents also and their political views. I would say this is more of an issue of time and place. You're allowed to have your political opinions. There are times that political opinions are expressed. I'm not sure an after-school program is the time for that political discussion. So I'd probably have a discussion with the students in your program as well as the parents, not about the politics, but more about time and place.
Let's go to Ryan in Manchester. Hi, Ryan. Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, go right ahead.
Hi, I'm actually a former student of Mr. Drybletz from Arlington Elementary School. And
hey,
I've recently joined law enforcement, and I just wanted to kind of congratulate and thank both of your speakers today for doing the work that they are, and just to tell them that, you know, being in law enforcement, I look forward to kind of working in this area and just helping the cause.
Ryan, I appreciate you sharing your perspective and what you learned from Mike Dryblatt. Thank you for calling in. Let's go to John calling in from Richmond. Hi, John. Your perspective.
Hi, Jane. I just wanted to comment. It's a big problem, and we're talking about specific components of where it shows up in the community. And, you know, I think the challenge is how do you address this? As a parent, I am both my child's best advocate. Hopefully they'll feel open enough and secure enough to come to me if there's a problem. I would be that trusted adult, but I'm also potentially the worst example. You know, some of these behaviors come out of what's happening at home. So I think there is a lot of expertise in the school systems, but it's also, if it's happening in high school, it's almost too late. the intervention happens to happen early when the consequences are far less significant, and it's readily redirected. So, I don't have a solution, but it's, I think the more we focus earlier on and intervening appropriately, and including parents in that process, I think we can reduce issues down the line.
John, I appreciate your perspective. Thanks for that. Bernice, we just have a second, but what about this role of parents?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we hope, right, and we that parents are well-intended in teaching their young kiddos strong skills to build positive relationships. But parents are just one context in which young people interact. There's the media, TV, society writ large, right? So again, it has to be a multifaceted approach where parents can filter some of that, but to some degree, you have to let your kids fly, right? And so that's where I was saying having those grounded norms at the parent and home level, and then you hope that your child will instill that in their peer groups. But you should notice any check-in signs that seem bizarre to you and engage early. Don't wait for the signs to be much later. And have open space for conversations that seem benign, but you can utilize stories, like one listener said, or movies or other neutral things to have harder conversation topics.
Boy, this is a conversation that we could take in many, many different directions and have an hour-long chat on each one. I appreciate both of you being open to having this sort of wide-ranging conversation now, and we can come back to some of those topics in later shows. Bernice Garnett is chair of the Agency of Education's Harassment, Hazing, and Bullying Advisory Council. She's also a professor of education at UVM. Thanks very much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Mike Dryblatt is a member of the Advisory Council and the president of Stand Up to Bullying, an organization that conducts workshops and presentations on all types of bullying prevention. Mike, thank you.
My pleasure.
Coming up, a new comic on the scene in Vermont, Lady Broad Ledger. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. How often does a creative person get an invitation like this from a publication? Quote, "There is no content restriction for this issue. Write and draw whatever you would like to. Sex, drugs, and excessive swearing is totally permitted." Those are the submission guidelines for a new publication called The Lady Broad Ledger. It's a self-described femme alt comics newspaper. Where there is a parameter is in who's featured in the paper. The creator is Stephanie Zuppo, and she says she's looking for lady-identified, lady-presenting, or lady-like people who make comics in Vermont. Stephanie, welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm excited to talk with you about Lady Broad Ledger.
Thank you for having me.
So, first of all, the title, Lady Broad Ledger, where does that come from?
So there was a group of us, lady comics creators. We had, like, this really awesome comics reading last spring, and we were like, let's kind of like build on that and put out a publication. So we all got together and someone suggested the name, and we were all like totally in love with it. It's really silly and I really like it.
So lady is clearly a big part of here, but you are not looking at the gender binary and saying only women. You know, this is sort of a broad scope of femme type identified cartoonists. Why are you sort of broadening that perspective but also keeping it?
Yeah. I think like lady creators should definitely be featured more often in comics because a lot of people really do think of it kind of like a boys club. So like it's starting to grow into more lady creators, especially in alt comics, which I think is really, really awesome. And a lot of the larger publishers are starting to take notice, like Marvel and DC are hiring more and more female creators. So that's really, really nice. But I also feel as if you have like if you have female experience as a non-binary person or a trans person, like that is totally valid and you should definitely submit.
And do you have people, are you seeing some responses from different comics of different stripes in Vermont?
Yeah. So we have a wide variety of submissions. Everyone kind of has their own style and their own subject that they like working with. We have people in the publication. We have like natural science illustrators. We have someone who works on Greek and archaeological comics, someone who is like a World War I and World War II buff and does beautiful, beautiful comics about like veterans. And then we have people who like, you know, sillier comics. We have Rachel Lindsay, who's in 7 Days, has a weekly strip there. We have Iona Fox, who does a lot of farming comics, which are really, really interesting about like her life in Vermont. I love featuring such a wide variety of work, which is one of the reasons I don't want a restriction on content. I just want to see what everyone can bring to the table and play to their strengths.
Yeah, you have now in front of, you brought in the hard copies, mm-hmm. and I've been looking online. You can actually get it either way, and it's free for people.
It's free.
You do invite people to pay for the online version if they have a price
they'd
like to suggest. but it's very cool to have this hard copy, and maybe you could just describe the cover artwork so people can get a sense of what this is like.
So the cover is by Glynis Fox. She does, there's actually a great interview with her on the back as well. She does a lot of archaeological illustration as like her day job. She's a fantastic illustrator and a fantastic cartoonist. So the cover was done by her, and it's kind of like Greek, like Minoan gods, I guess, going off into
it's like a minotaur.
Like a minotaur, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Going off into a labyrinth after a party and kind of like disappearing. You don't really know what's happened with them. Yeah, she's just like a really fantastic cartoonist. She said that she wanted to kind of work more with the story too, so I'm hoping maybe in future issues it'll be continued, which would be really cool.
And then you have, another one, How to Make Finnish Pie, and it's actually a recipe.
Yeah, it's a recipe comic that is by my friend Bridget. She does comics mostly about like gnomes, and they're really like they're kids friendly, and like I welcome that that as well. If you want to do a kids friendly comic, by all means.
But you do have a disclaimer on the front that says not for kids.
Not for kids.
Yeah, just so they know, that you're not handing this to your kids without reading it.
Yeah, there's no like graphic content. It's really just kind of subject matter in this issue. Like there's a lot of comics about death and politics and stuff like that.
So you've put this out. You're trying to put it out semi-regularly, mm-hmm. But you're doing it, it's a free publication. How are you funding it?
So this one was crowdfunded on GoFundMe, and we managed to fund the entire printing. I found like a really nice, cheap printer out of state. Ideally, I would love to find a printer in state, but I think that's going to take me some time. I was having a really hard time finding one. But I was able to find like a fairly cheap printer, and we raised all the money on GoFundMe, and I'm hoping in the future we might do ads, we might try looking into grants. There's a variety of things that we could do. But it's actually based on a comic called Secret Prison out of Philadelphia that I used to pick up when I was younger, which was another free comics newspaper of like all Indian alternative cartoonists. And they crowdfunded it as well. So they were able to, I think they put out 7 or 8 issues just through crowdfunding.
So how many issues are you hoping that you can put out? Is this like just an ongoing concern for you? You're going to keep doing it as long as you can?
As long as I can, definitely. Twice a year for, as long as I can.
And right now you're driving around and distributing this to various workplaces and shops and stuff in Vermont. It's all on your shoulders?
For the most part, I've had a few people come and ask for copies to take, say, like Middlebury. I've had like a lot of the contributors also I've given them a stack, and they're like dropping them off in other places in Burlington that I haven't been able to. But for the most part, it has been me just driving around when the weather's nice. Like this weekend, I wasn't able to go anywhere because of the storm, but I want to get it out to as many towns in Vermont as possible.
Is it fun, or does this now feel like you've taken on a lot of work?
It's so much fun. I love it. this is kind of what I've always wanted to do. So this is great.
So when you are getting feedback from people that are not just your friends mm-hmm. and family who are, they're contractually required to like this.
Yeah.
What are you hearing from people?
Everyone's been really supportive so far. We've had a few people like post on Facebook with giving their support, and some people on like Instagram, which is where I've been posting all of the drop-off locations for the comic. Everyone's been really, really supportive. They let us know when they've found a copy and when they don't. And then, like, I mean, just having, like, the interview here and also in 7 days has been really cool because I didn't expect people to, like, be so supportive and, like, jump on it so quickly. So it's been really, really awesome.
If there are any lady-identifying, lady-presenting, or lady-like people who make cartoons and are listening right now, how did they submit to the next episode?
Okay, so we have a website, ladybroadledger.com. We also have a Facebook page. I put out the call for submissions on there, so you can definitely take a look at that online. In the back of the comic also, if you manage to get a physical copy, there is also a call for submissions in the back.
And we will put a link up on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net for anyone who didn't catch that. Stephanie Zuppo is a Winooski cartoonist and the editor and designer of the Lady Broad Ledger. Thank you so much for talking with us about
it. Thank you.
And that does it for today's show. Tomorrow, an update on how lawmakers in Montpelier are responding to President Trump's orders on immigration. Plus, an exit interview of sorts with former U.S. Attorney Eric Miller and a conversation with Vermont-raised choreographer Moses Pendleton. It's one of our trademark Vermont Edition smorgasbords tomorrow at noon, so be sure to listen in. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.